In the second episode of the 1984 Book Club Conspiracy Classics, we break down the rest of Orwell's dystopian prophecy and compare it directly to the world we're living in today, from mass surveillance and corporate government collusion to psychological control, digital memory holes, and media-driven doublethink. 1984 is a blueprint for the Dark Enlightenment. Is Big Brother now Big Tech? Are we living through 2 minutes of hate on our feeds every day? The parallels will shock you, and they're hiding in plain sight. Join me as we continue our journey through the reddest pill of them all. Now, if for some reason you're stumbling upon this episode, this is part two of our 1984 book club. You're going to want to go listen to part one, because in the part one we went through, part one of the book, because there's three parts of 1984, the book. We covered part one in episode one, and now we're going to cover part two and three in episode two. And then stay subscribed, because we're coming back with episode number three, where we talk about who George Orwell was, and we see if, in fact, we are living through a 1984 Dark Enlightenment. Plot spoiler, probably so. Probably so. So, and I'm just picking up where Alex Jones left us all behind, you know? He used to be the guy that warned us of all this stuff, and I'm apparently, he says everything's great now. And I'm like, okay, well, I don't believe that, because I read this book, and now I'm fired up, okay? So, I got a lot to read to you today, and this is the second part. The first part was a lot of reading, but it's important because I'm going to get you through this book in less than 2 hours. And the book, like I said in part one, it's fine. I mean, I struggle with fictional books anyway, but I find it to be kind of boring. So I'm going to try to just give you the bare essentials of what's going on so we can have a educated conversation in part three. All right, let's go. So we are in 1984. We're in part two of the book, chapter one. Winston, our protagonist, he hooks up with the dark-haired woman, you know, the one that's he was talking about. He wanted to slice her throat while she was busting nuts. What? And this woman's been following him, and now he wants to hook up with her. Because remember, at the end of part one of the book, he went and rented an apartment that doesn't have a telescreen. Like, he's going off-grid, sort of, right? Because he was struggling with this idea of rebelling against the system. He really doesn't trust Big Brother. And he's like, man, something's wrong here. Something ain't right. And he goes to rent an apartment because he wants to sort of, dabble. So him and old girl with the dark hair, they got to keep this thing on the DL, right? And they suggest, the reading suggests, like, she could be some kind of intel agent, in my personal opinion, when I read it. So I'm like, do I trust this lady? I don't know. She covertly gives Winston a folded up paper that says, I love you. And they do this very secretly. They have to make sure the telescreens don't see any of this, because we talked a little bit about the idea of sex in the world of 1984. And as to be expected, they look down upon it, right? Anything that restricts the ranges of consciousness, that's what Big Brother is about. They're like, no fun, sexy time, no words, right? All these words are expanding your range of consciousness. We got to keep you stupid and uneducated. That's their goal. Because if you're uneducated, they could fill your head with nonsense. Conspiracy theories, if you will. So that's chapter one. Then chapter two, Winston and Julia. We finally get Dark Hair's name. Her name is Julia. Winston and Julia, they've been messing around. They finally get it in. They're sneaking out to the countryside. His Riz game is ultra strong. He says, I hated the sight of you. I wanted to rape you. And then murder you afterwards. 2 weeks ago, I thought of seriously smashing your head in with a cobblestone. If you really want to know, I imagine that you had something to do with the thought police. The girl laughed delightedly, evidently taking this as a tribute to the excellence of her disguise. Not the thought police. You didn't honestly think that. Yeah, my man's a weirdo, dude. I don't know how he ended up getting any chick to hang out with him, but here we are. And apologies for my voice. I'm extra Alex Jonesy today. At the CrossFit, we did a high-intensity workout, and now I got Fran cough, so this ought to be fun. My apologies in advance, but I got to get it done. I got to get this episode recorded, all right? Okay. So Julia, she works with a bunch of spies. Turns out she does have intel connections. She works with the Junior Anti-Sex League. This is all like government propaganda stuff, Big Brother. And at the end of the chapter, he, Winston, says how all the emotions get mixed together and they don't have a pure emotion like love. And this is very much like that range of consciousness thing. It's reducing the number of words we use. It's a very utilitarian, I would dare I say, tech bro fantasy. Lack of emotions, lack of empathy, that's what they're all about, okay? And they say that having sex is actually a political statement for our main character, for Winston. And he's basically saying, look, I control my body, I control my sexy time, not you, Big Brother. F off. So now we're in chapter 3. Winston and Julia, they agree to keep meeting up, but they got to keep changing up the locations and so on when they meet up to keep it secret. Julia, we find out, is 26. Winston is 39. There, it's given my boy Leo DiCaprio, all right? But, Leo's great. Julia, I was at to defend my man Leo. You know, he's hanging out at Diddy parties. He's messing around with girls in their 20s. I'm like, come on, Leo. Get it together, buddy. Julia works in the fiction department writing novels. And in the porno sec, because remember we talked about porno sec in part one, making porno for the proles, the proletariats, and she was making titles like Spanking Stories. I'm going to read you from the book. He learned with astonishment that all the workers in porno sec, except the heads of the departments, were girls. The theory was that men whose sex instincts were less controllable than those of women were in greater danger of being corrupted by the filth they handled. They don't even like having married women there, she added. Girls are always supposed to be pure. Here's one who isn't, anyway. Then we move on, and this is kind of an important part of the book here. They talk about how they're indoctrinated to believe sex should be done not for pleasure, not for love, but for duty to the party, which I asserted in part one. That's kind of how Elon Musk talks, right? Elon's talking about like, oh, we need to make children for the future of this country. How is that much different? Tell me how that's much different, okay? Because in 1984, it's like the whole idea of 1984, you know, to give you a little sneak peek, is adoration of your government slave master. Admiration for Big Brother, for the party. So everything you do needs to be thinking of them. You're supposed to be having sex. They're like, oh, yeah, this is for our president or whatever. You know, like it's crazyville. The party, the government, thought that sex perversion ends up in creating hysteria. And when you make love, you feel good and relaxed. So they are suppressing the sex drive in order to steer that energy into the party. I'm going to read you from the book. It says, unlike Winston, she had grasped the inner meaning of the party's sexual puritanism. It was not merely that the sex instinct created a world of its own, which was outside the party's control and which therefore had to be destroyed if possible. What was more important was that sexual privation induced hysteria, which was desirable because it could be transformed into war fever and leader worship. The way she put it was, when you make love, you're using up energy, and afterwards you feel happy and don't give a damn for anything. They can't bear you to feel like that. They want you to be bursting with energy all the time. All this marching up and down and cheering and waving flags is simply sex gone sour. If you're happy inside yourself, why should you get excited about Big Brother and the 3-year plans and the 2 minutes of hate and all the rest of their bloody rot? That was very true, he thought. There was a direct, intimate connection between chastity and political orthodoxy. For how could the fear, the hatred, and the lunatic credulity which the party needed in its members be kept at the right pitch, except by bottling down some powerful instinct and using it as a driving force? The sex impulse was dangerous to the party, and the party had turned it to account. They had played a similar trick with the instinct of parenthood. The family could not actually be abolished. And indeed, people were encouraged to be fond of their children in almost the old-fashioned way. The children, on the other hand, who we learn about in part one being snitches, were systematically turned against their parents and taught to spy on them and report their deviations. The family had become, in effect, an extension of the thought police. It was a device by means of which everyone could be surrounded night and day by informers who knew him intimately. And this is like the idea David Icke talks about in, I believe it's Freedom Road. He talks about the prison without the bars and how it's easier to control us by having us police ourselves. You can, I think he describes it as like, if there's one wolf, you can kind of corral the sheep with one wolf, but not that well if there's too many sheep. So what you got to do is program the sheep to warn each other, to be like, hey, don't go over there. Don't do this. Don't do that. Don't do this. Don't do that. And that's kind of what this future looks like. And the sexual puritanism is kind of like very hand. I don't know. I shouldn't say that. I've only seen a couple episodes of Handmaid's Tale, but it sounds kind of like that. I could be wrong about how they depict sex. But think about this. It's, you know, there's all these reports and studies about how the amount of sex people are having is going down. And you've got this prominence of incels, and incels, I mean, predominantly lean one way, right? And it could be that they're taking advantage of that sex drive. This is probably some kind of Freudian psychoanalysis. But my point is that in 1984, they were talking about this exact idea. All right, we'll talk more in part three. So we finally find out why these kids are snitches. The children are turned against their parents so that they could become an extension of the thought police in order to snitch on each other, which is very much what David Icke talks about, right? Now we're in chapter four. Winston and Julia, they're using the room that Winston's renting to, you know, sexy time. They talk about how they love real coffee and real food because they can't get that in their 1984 world there of Oceania. They hate the party. They hate Big Brother. Oh, dear. I love coffee. I do hate Big Brother. Maybe I'm in 1984. Then we're in chapter five. Remember Syme? I never did know how to say his name. I didn't even bother looking it up. My apologies. Syme. He was the guy that was writing that Newspeak dictionary. Remember? He was like, oh, this is going to be great. We're going to reduce the number of words, and it's such a waste for people to have all these flowery words. Well, he's gone. Vaporized. It's murder. Ja Rule showing up at the 1984 book club. Yeah, he's gone. See ya never, loser. What'd you do? And we find out that the government's prepping for Hate Week, all right? Because remember in the first part, we talked about 2 minutes of hate where they show that Goldstein guy, the rebellion dude, and everyone's like, ah, we hate him. And it's supposed to sort of, as we learned, redirect the sexual energy into hatred of the enemy, which therefore makes you supportive of your government, Big Brother. So they're prepping for a thing called Hate Week, you know, like Haters Ball. They got the Haters Ball. I hate you. I hate you. I don't even know you. And they have a new song called the Hate Song, right? And, you know, Julia starts talking about fake news. And again, this is 1984, written in 1949. Back then, no one doubted the news at all. So, like, that's pretty telling. That because today's news, on the left and the right, you know, fake news all around. It's all bought and paid for by billionaires. I'm not saying that everything the news says is a lie. I'm not saying that at all. But I am saying that they filter everything through a bias. They choose to omit certain stories. They choose to make certain stories the top headline. And it's all feeding the narratives of stoking a two-party system, right? Which I'm against, vehemently against. I'm registered unaffiliated. I vote third party often. And yeah, I just think that the two-party system is just a way of leveraging that Hegelian dialect. Save this for part three. Got a lot to get through. And Winston's trying to tell her that the media is charged to call out other countries as enemies and how they abolished the past. Listen to what's said here. In some ways, she was far more acute than Winston and far less susceptible to party propaganda. Once, when he happened in some connection to mention the war against Eurasia, she startled him by saying casually that in her opinion, the war was not happening. Because remember, Winston lives in Oceania. There's only a few continents, and Eurasia is a different continent, and they're the enemy, and they're supposed to hate them, right? The rocket bombs which fell daily on London were probably fired by the government of Oceania itself, just to keep people frightened. This was an idea that had literally never occurred to him. She also stirred a sort of envy in him by telling him that during the 2 minutes of hate, her great difficulty was to avoid bursting out laughing. She's like ultra OG granola woke, right? She's not falling for this nonsense. The whole time Winston is like, I don't know. I kind of don't think it's true. He's more like me. I don't know, man. Something's weird. And she's already down the rabbit hole. She's like, bitch, please. It's all fake news. But she only questioned the teachings of the party when they in some way touched upon her own life. Often she was ready to accept the official mythology simply because the difference between truth and falsehood did not seem important to her. She believed, for instance, having learned it at school, that the party had invented aeroplanes. In his own school days, Winston remembered in the late 50s, it was only the helicopter that the party claimed to have invented. A dozen years later, when Julia was at school, it was already claiming the aeroplane, one generation more, and it would be claiming the steam engine. Because you remember in bar one, Winston had this whole thing of like, dude, I know the government didn't invent the plane. It's been around long before that. And when he told her that aeroplanes had been in existence before he was born and long before the revolution, the fact struck her as totally uninteresting. After all, what did it matter who invented aeroplanes? It was rather more of a shock to him when he discovered from some chance remark that she did not remember that Oceania, 4 years ago, had been at war with East Asia and at peace with Eurasia. It was true that she regarded the whole war as a sham, but apparently she had not even noticed that the name of the enemy had changed. I thought we'd always been at war with Eurasia, she said vaguely. It frightened him a little. The invention of aeroplanes dated from long before her birth, but the switchover in the war had happened only 4 years ago, well after she was grown up. He argued with her about it for perhaps a quarter of an hour. In the end, he succeeded in forcing her memory back until she did dimly recall that at one time East Asia and not Eurasia had been the enemy. But the issue still struck her as unimportant. Who cares, she said impatiently. It's always one bloody war after another, and one knows the news is all lies anyway. Sounds very reminiscent, right? The news is so manipulated that it almost renders it useless. And that's the struggle these people have. They're like, I don't even know what's real anymore. And I feel that pain too, you know? I wish I grew up in the 50s and 60s with Walter Cronkite, and I was just like, yep, that's what happened. Sounds good, buddy. Nowadays, you got to consume 10 different sources and put it through filters and be like, okay, what bias is what? Chapter 6. O'Brien, remember, he's the inner party guy. He starts recruiting Winston into the rebellion, and he's talking smack about Syme. He's sort of like signaling, right? So, you know. And in the book, they talk about the process of rebellion, and there's a process that they view this rebellion as why they have a thought police, and you can't think these things because thoughts lead to writing, which lead to action, okay? In the book, it says, he knew that sooner or later, he would obey O'Brien's summons, perhaps tomorrow, perhaps after a long delay. He was not certain. What was happening was only the working out of a process that had started years ago. The first step had been a secret, involuntary thought. The second had been the opening of the diary. He had moved from thoughts to words, and now from words to actions. The last step was something that would happen in the Ministry of Love. He had accepted it. The end was contained in the beginning. Because remember, he wrote that diary. He was like, down with Big Brother, right? He was thinking it, and then he wrote it down. And now look at this guy trying to get him in the rebellion. Chapter 7. Winston keeps having dreams about his mother and this golden country pasture. That kind of matters later. For some reason, my brain goes to the Eleusinian fields. I don't know. Do it that way, you will. And he talks about how if they get caught, you know, fooling around, they're cooked. They're as good as dead. They know this. And they talk in the book about like, oh, they're gonna torture us. They're gonna you know, force us to confess. Winston says, hey, the party can't make me not love you. It's the one thing they can't do, right? I can always love you. I can say this. I can say that. The love will always be there. Oh, hold that. Oh, hold the beer. Okay. And he basically goes on. He's like, they can make you say things, but you don't have to believe it, right? They can't get inside of you enough to make you believe things. You can say it, whatever. Okay. All right. Let's keep that energy up when you're in the torture room, Winston. Chapter 8. They go to O'Brien's house, and he's like, look, I can turn off these telescreens. And Winston starts dropping knowledge because they're trying to recruit Winston into the rebellion. Okay. Shall I say it or will you? He said. I will say it, said Winston promptly. That thing is really turned off? Yes, everything is turned off. We are alone. We have come here because, he paused, realizing for the first time the vagueness of his own motives. Since he did not, in fact, know what kind of help he expected from O'Brien, it was not easy to say why he had come here. He went on, conscious that what he was saying must sound both feeble and pretentious. We believe that there is some kind of conspiracy, some kind of secret organization working against the party, and that you are involved with it. We want to join it and work for it. We are enemies of the party. We disbelieve in the principles of Ingsoc. We are thought criminals. We are also adulterers. I tell you this because we want to put ourselves at your mercy. If you want us to incriminate ourselves in any other way, we are ready. So, now O'Brien's like, all right, bet. You know, real recognize real. And O'Brien introduces, at this point, Winston and Julia into the resistance, the rebellion. Okay. I think they call it the Brotherhood, which is confusing because you got Big Brother as the government, a.k.a. the party. Now you got the Brotherhood, which is the rebellion. They start drinking some wine. They had never heard of wine. And this is part of the restricting of consciousness, right? Get rid of drugs, any kind of mind-expanding hallucinogens, alcohol, anything, right? Except for gin, which I don't get. Like, what, they can get drunk off gin? They can't drink the wine? I don't really get it. And O'Brien's like, hey, you ready to die for this? And of course, they're like, hell yeah, bro. And he gives them the book, right? And the book is written by Goldstein. That's the guy that they all hate. That's the 2 minutes of hate guy at the haters ball that are like, hate, 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 hate. Well, he wrote a book, and the book reveals the truth. It talks about controlling the people. All right, listen to this. In the book, he says, excuse me. He filled the glasses and raised his own glass by the stem. What shall it be this time, he said, still with the same faint suggestion of irony. To the confusion of the thought police? To the death of Big Brother? To humanity? To the future? To the past, said Winston. The past is more important. Agreed O'Brien, gravely. Dun, dun, dun. Okay, chapter 9. And this chapter is massive. And it's probably the one that needs the most attention, appropriately so. And I would argue that this was Orson Welles' aim for this whole book, is just to say this chapter to everyone, okay? So it's kind of important. So pay attention. Lock in, folks. This hate week thing is coming to an end, and it was, of course, full of hating on Eurasia, the enemy, the new enemy, and they were hanging war criminals and so on. And the party switches it up, and they say, oh, you know what? We've always been allies with Eurasia. It's East Asia we're beefing with. It's always been East Asia. Straight up lying right to their faces. And the brain dead sheep are like, you know what? You're right. You know what? I like what you're saying. I agree. It has always been East Asia, huh? And it's like, it's incredible, right? Winston, he reads the book, which is titled The Theory and Practice of Oligarchical Collectivism. All right. And the chapters have interesting titles. Ignorance is Strength and War is Peace, which are the party slogans. So it's deliberately unpacking each talking point like war is peace, okay? And this is how deep backs it. It says, in one combination or another, these three superstates are permanently at war and have been so for the past 25 years. War, however, is no longer the desperate, annihilating struggle that it was in the early decades of the 20th century. It is a warfare of limited aims between combatants who are unable to destroy one another. having no material cause for fighting and are not divided by any genuine ideological difference. This is not to say that either the conduct of war or the prevailing attitude towards it has become less bloodthirsty or more chivalrous. On the contrary, war hysteria is continuous and universal in all countries, and such acts as raping, looting, the slaughter of children, the reduction of whole populations to slavery, and reprisals against prisoners, which extend even to boiling and burying alive, are looked upon as normal, and when they are committed by one's own side and not by the enemy, meritorious. But in a physical sense, war involves very small numbers of people, mostly highly trained specialists, and causes comparatively few casualties, which, I mean, that kind of sounds like how war is done today. If you ever watched G.I. Joe, I watched G.I. Joe growing up, like, heavily. And they're always shooting at each other, the red and the blue bullets, and, like, no one ever dies. No one ever dies. Not saying that they should, I'm just saying, like, that's how it goes. Let me keep reading. The primary aim of modern warfare, in accordance with the principles of doublethink, this aim is simultaneously recognized and not recognized by the directing brains of the inner party, is to use up the products of the machine without raising the general standard of living. Huh? Without raising the general standard of living. Ever since the end of the 19th century, the problem of what to do with the surplus of consumption goods has been latent in industrial society. Now, doublethink is explained later in the chapter better. I'm going to explain it. I'm going to read you that part now because you got to understand what he's saying here. To tell deliberate lies while genuinely believing in them, to forget any fact that has become inconvenient, and then, when it becomes necessary again, to draw it back from oblivion for just so long as it's needed, to deny the existence of objective reality, and all the while to take account of the reality which one denies. All this is indispensably necessary. Even in using the word doublethink, it is necessary to exercise doublethink. And the idea is that they're blatantly lying and they're, I mean, just pulling stuff out of their butt to convince you to follow their agenda. It's like how, you know, certain people ran for positions to expose the Epstein list, and then now it's like, no, that's just a hoax. It's fake news. And everyone's like, what are you talking about? And it's like, hey, there's no video camera footage of Epstein's cell. Then they're like, hey, we got footage of Epstein's cell. What? And then they're like, oh, but it's missing a minute. Just kidding. Here's a minute. It's like, bro, this is crazy. Because they want full and utter adoration and idolization of the party. And to just support whatever it is they say. But the wars that they talk about are not meant to ever be over. It's a continuous effort to control everyone and keep everyone scared. Because when you're filled with fear, you look for someone to protect you. Okay? And the book also talks about the cycles of humanity always running with the elites and the poors, you know, your high, middle, low class. And the middle class eventually overthrows the high class, and then they become the high class, while the low class, the proles, always stay poor. And the party was able to make sure that the middle class could never do this, that they could never achieve power or wealth. And, of course, the low-class proles, they stay distracted, so they don't even want any of these things. In the book, it says this. Under this lies a fact never mentioned aloud, but tacitly understood and acted upon, namely that the conditions of life in all three superstates are very much the same. In Oceania, the prevailing philosophy is called INSOC. In Eurasia, it's called Neo-Bolshevism. And in East Asia, it is called by a Chinese name, usually translated as death worship, but perhaps better rendered as obliteration of the self. The citizen of Oceania is not allowed to know anything of the tenets of the other two philosophies, but he is taught to execrate them as barbarous outrages upon morality and common sense. Actually, the three philosophies are barely distinguishable, and the social systems which they support are not distinguishable at all. Everywhere there is the same pyramid structure, the same worship of semi-divine leader, the same economy existing by and for continuous warfare. It follows that the three superstates not only cannot conquer one another, but would gain no advantage by doing so. And this makes me think about how confusing it is to hear about how, you know, fascism is the worst thing ever, communism is the worst thing ever, and they're both on opposite ends of the spectrum. One's heavy right, one's heavy left. Yet they both end up identical with a totalitarian government dictator and, you know, oppressive regimes that never leave the office, right? And doublethink is about accepting contradictions that the party presents, like war is peace, which Bill Cooper talked about, the idea of keeping sovereignty through a strong military, which I believe mostly, so like maybe I'm brainwashed. It says, the essential act of war is destruction, not necessarily of human lives, but of the products of human labor. War is a way of shattering to pieces or pouring into the stratosphere or sinking in the depths of the sea, materials which might otherwise be used to make the masses too comfortable and hence, in the long run, too intelligent. Boom, boom, boom. Rastafari horn. Too educated. And this is why I'm always like, man, I support education no matter how that looks. Just don't go into debt unless you can make that up over a lifetime of wages doing a better job. You know, but to just what I don't like about the conspiracy movement is this idea of crapping on the idea of college, of higher education, of reading, of consuming the news. Like, it turns into real black pill territory, and it ends up being like, well, the only person you should listen to is me. I'm the only one you should listen to. You know, college is just indoctrination, and I get it. Like, there's very much like leftist stances that you can consume in some colleges. That wasn't my case. Well, maybe it was. Maybe it was, to be fair. But that doesn't make it wrong, okay? The whole thing I had learned in college and every course I took, and in fact, my senior thesis was the class I took right before it was like this whole idea of continuing education after college and the importance of lifelong learning. Like, that was a major theme in college, was you got to keep learning. That's why I started the Illuminati Watcher blog forever ago, because I was just used to reading, researching, regurgitating. And you kind of become conditioned for it and addicted to it in a way. So after like 6 years of doing that, like drinking from a fire hose about engineering and mathematics and philosophy and all my generals that I took, it felt weird. Like, I remember I got done with school and I had a 2-year break before I started grad school. And I was like, well, now what do I do? And I started learning Texas Hold'em. I was playing poker online, which you could do back then. I don't know if you can anymore, but it was banned for a long time. And I was playing penny, like, I mean, I'm talking like I would load $20 in there and make it last a month or two. Hell, maybe even longer. And I just thought, well, this is kind of a waste. It just felt like a waste to me. It just wasn't enriching. So anyway, like, college is what gave me that, because I was a real dumb. I mean, I wasn't ever, I'm not a stupid human being. Like, I was always pretty good at comprehension and reading and all that stuff. But like, I'm not, I was a lot dumber before college. That's a fact. That's a total fact. Anyway, the point is, the party, the system, the oppressors love the uneducated. They love it. Because because as human beings, we crave truth and we look for information, right? And if they're like, hey, don't trust none of these people, but you can listen to us. We got this, you know, this platform will tell you what to think. They love that. So Winston is reading all of this from the book, from Goldstein's The Book, and Julia realizes, like, oh, snap, there's a telescreen behind a picture on your wall. Uh-oh. It's the Thought Police. That's right. This apartment he was renting, turns out, fake news there. They had a telescreen the whole time. That's not good. They were voyeuring the whole time. Part 3. Look at it, we're cruising right along. Chapter 1 and Part 3. Winston's in lockup, right? And he thinks he may be in the Ministry of Love with a bunch of other thought prisoners. They don't really detail, but they basically get arrested because of the telescreens, excuse me. Perhaps maybe his own mother's in there because he keeps dreaming about his mom, right? And O'Brien said they don't save any rebellion folks who get caught, but what they will do in the Brotherhood and the Rebellion, they're going to send you a razor so you can, you know, Epstein out. And note in the very beginning of the book, Winston talks about how hard it is to get razors and shoelaces, which are, you know, the primary, you know, weapons for the Epstein treatment in the prisons. Now, chapter eight, part two, O'Brien talks to Winston. Listen to this. He says, "We never help our members. At most, when it is absolutely necessary that someone be silenced, we're occasionally able to smuggle a razor blade into a prisoner's cell. You will have to get used to living without results and without hope. You will work for a while, you will be caught, you will confess, and then you'll die. Those are the only results that you will ever see. There's no possibility that..." Oh, that's where it cuts off. Yeah, I should have cut that last sentence off, sorry. "Those are the only results that you'll ever see." So, Winston, he's in there and he sees a poet he knows named Ampleforth. And Ampleforth is getting dragged to this room 101, which I found to be interesting symbolism here, because we saw room 101 in the Matrix. In the Gnostic prison sense, this is similar, right? They're both trapped in they're trapped in hell. And Neo is the one, right? He was the neophyte, the one to change it all. So I'm thinking in the book, I'm like, is Winston going to be the one? Is he going to be the one that breaks down the Big Brother? We're going to find out. One, of course, being the foundational number. So Winston, he sees his neighbor Parsons in there. And, you know, even he was a real loyal guy to the party. What happened? You didn't hear much about Parsons. I cut out a lot of the stuff in the book. Well, what happened was Parsons' daughter snitched on him. Dude, these damn kids. Worse yet, Parsons is glad that he got turned in. He's like, "Oh, man, you know, I was worried I was going to get too rebellious. I was saying, you know, I was in his sleep. He was saying, 'Down with Big Brother.' And that was enough to get him arrested. But he's like, 'Oh, thank goodness they stopped me before I went too far.'" They're all cucks for the government. O'Brien comes in, and we find out that he got arrested a long time ago. So now it's like, wait a minute, what? Okay, chapter two. Winston, he's getting tortured. He's getting beat up. He starts admitting to stuff. Like, he's like, "Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I admire capitalism. Oh, I love sex." You know? But not all the crimes that he's accused of. So they're like, "You're going to confess to all the crimes, fool." So they take him to a torture room. And I thought, and I was confused because I thought the torture room was room 101, but it's not. Okay? They take him to a different torture room. And strangely enough, O'Brien's in there, and he's now orchestrating torture. Electrical stuff. Zapping. And he keeps wanting Winston to confess to all these conspiracies that he believed were wrong. Stuff like how he saw the photo evidence that he would have when he was burning things at the Ministry of Truth. All this, you know, his thoughts about the airplane, all that stuff. And Winston, he starts singing Rage Against the Machine. I'm just joking. This is what he says in the book. "There's a party slogan dealing with the control of the past," he said. "Repeat it, if you please." And he says, "Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past," repeated Winston obediently. "Who controls the present controls the past," said O'Brien, nodding his head with slow approval. "Is it your opinion, Winston, that the past has real existence?" They debate what the past is at this point. But O'Brien tells him what's up. He says, "Winston, that reality is not external. Reality exists in the human mind, nowhere else. Not in the individual mind, which can make mistakes, and in any case, soon perishes. Only in the mind of the party, which is collective and immortal. Whatever the party holds to be truth is truth. It is impossible to see reality except by looking through the eyes of the party. That is the fact that you have to relearn, Winston." Then O'Brien, he keeps going, you know, big speech. "Do you remember," he went on, "writing in your diary, 'Freedom is the freedom to say that 2 + 2 = 4. "Yes," said Winston. O'Brien held his left hand, its back towards Winston, with the thumb hidden and 4 fingers extended. "How many fingers am I holding up, Winston?"
4.
"And if the party says that is not 4 but 5, then how many?"
4.
"Ooh, he's being a brat. Ooh, you're being a brat. Beat up the brat. Beat up the brat." With a baseball bat. O'Brien, he keeps. Sorry, I'm trying to jazz this up, folks. I mean, I know I don't normally do that. I got to jazz it up because it's kind of boring content. But this last part is the best part of the whole book. All right, and we're getting real close. So O'Brien keeps torturing Winston. He's like, bro, you got to say the five fingers thing. When I'm holding up four fingers, you're going to say five fingers. He keeps doing that. And then he drops the coldest thing ever. I'm trying not to swear because I'm trying to build my YouTube here. He drops the coldest line ever on Winston. Listen to this. The first thing for you to understand is that in this place, there are no martyrdoms. You have read of the religious persecutions of the past. In the Middle Ages, there was the Inquisition. It was a failure. It set out to eradicate heresy and ended by perpetuating it. For every heretic it burned at the stake, thousands of others rose up. Why was that? Because the Inquisition killed its enemies in the open and killed them while they were still unrepentant. In fact, it killed them because they were unrepentant. Men were dying because they would not abandon their true beliefs. Naturally, all the glory belonged to the victim and all the shame to the Inquisitor who burned him. Later in the 20th century, they were the totalitarians, as they were called. They were the German Nazis and the Russian communists. The Russians persecuted heresy more cruelly than the Inquisition had done. And they had imagined that they had learned from the mistakes of the past. They knew at any rate that one must not make martyrs. Because they exposed their victims to public trial, they deliberately set themselves to destroy their dignity. They wore them down by torture and solitude until they were despicable, cringing wretches, confessing whatever was put into their mouths, covering themselves with abuse, accusing and sheltering behind one another, whimpering for mercy. And yet, after only a few years, the same thing had happened over again. The dead men had become martyrs, and their degradation was forgotten. Once again, why was it? In the first place, because the confessions that they had made were obviously extorted and untrue. We do not make mistakes of that kind. All the confessions that are uttered here are true. We make them true. And above all, we do not allow the dead to rise up against us. You must stop imagining that posterity will vindicate you, Winston. Posterity will never hear of you. You will be lifted clean out of the stream of history. We shall turn you into gas, pour you into the stratosphere. Nothing will remain of you, not a name in a register, not a memory in a living brain. You will be annihilated in the past as well as in the future. You will never have existed. Damn, bro. Damn. Why you got to be like that, O'Brien? Why you got to do him like that? Because remember, there was this whole thing of like destroying history and vaporizing people. That's why they do it. You got to go. You got to never exist it. Otherwise, people are going to be like, dude, the party is, they're terrible. They got martyrs and victims, and they can't have that. So Brian, he hits Winston with a new device that straps to his head, and it wipes his brain numb. And now when Winston sees the five fingers, he's like, okay, I'm good now. And so Winston is asked if he has any questions. And Winston asks about Julia. And O'Brien, who's turned out to be a double cross agent, right? O'Brien's like, bro, she betrayed you. And he's like, damn, man. You know, because he was in love with her. Chapter 3. Winston, still being tortured, O'Brien says he actually collaborated in writing Goldstein's The Book. What? That's right. It's conspiracy on conspiracy on conspiracy. O'Brien says it was all nonsense. There's no way for the proles to rebel because the party will reign forever. And the party seeks power for its own sake. Not to govern people and tell them what to do necessarily, all right? He explains it in his little lecture he gives. Now I will tell you the answer to my question. It is this. The party seeks power entirely for its own sake. We're not interested in the good of others. We are interested solely in power. Not wealth or luxury or long life or happiness. Only power. Pure power. What pure power means, you will understand presently. We are different from the oligarchies of the past, and what we know what we are doing, in that we know what we are doing. All the others, even those who resembled ourselves, were cowards and hypocrites. The German Nazis and the Russian communists came very close to us in their methods, but they never had the courage to recognize their own motives. They pretended, perhaps they even believed, that they had seized power unwittingly and for a limited time, and that just around the corner there lay a paradise where human beings would be free and equal. We are not like that. We know that no one ever seizes power with the intention of relinquishing it. Power is not a means, it is an end. One does not establish a dictatorship in order to safeguard a revolution. One makes the revolution in order to establish the dictatorship. The object of persecution is persecution. The object of torture is torture. The object of power is power. We are the priests of power, he said. God is power. Illuminate confirm. They want to be gods. They don't want to just like make rules. They want something beyond that. They want to be gods. And O'Brien, like these couple chapters, like spill all the beans. He says, you know the party slogan, freedom is slavery? Has it ever occurred to you that it is reversible? Slavery is freedom? Alone, free, the human being is always defeated. It must be so because every human being is doomed to die, which is the greatest of all failures. But if he can make complete, utter submission, if he can escape from his identity, if he can merge himself in the party so that he is the party, then he is all-powerful and immortal. The second thing for you to realize is that power is power over human beings, over the body, but above all, over the mind. Power over matter, external reality as you would call it, is not important. Already, our control over matter is absolute. We control matter because we control the mind. Reality is inside the skull. You will learn by degrees, Winston. There is nothing that we could not do. Invisibility, levitation, anything. I could float off this floor like a soap bubble if I wish to. I do not wish to because the party does not wish it. You must get rid of those 19th century ideas about the laws of nature. We make the laws of nature. All right. Now, to say reality is inside the skull is very much referencing the Plato's Republic and the, what do you call it? The cave? The parable of the cave? What do they call that? It's everything's going on is in the mind, right? They're seeing a movie on the wall of the cave, and then the one guy gets out, and he's like, bro, there's a whole world out here. And everyone in there is like, no, there isn't. That's what they're doing. They're you know, controlling their mind, controlling their thoughts, controlling reality. And this whole idea of freedom of slavery, in my interpretation, is basically the World Economic Forum's Great Reset idea. You'll own nothing and be happy. You will be a slave and you will be happy with your freedom. Then O'Brien says the most sort of summarizing explanation of what we need to look for if we worry about this nightmare future. And again, cold-blooded is what he says. Ours is founded upon hatred. In our world, there will be no emotions except fear, rage, triumph, and self-abasement. Everything else we shall destroy. Everything. Already we are breaking down the habits of thought which have survived from before the revolution. We have cut the links between child and parent, and between man and man, and between man and woman. And this is where a lot of the conspiracy people get into that breakdown of the family structure, and this is kind of where that comes from. No one dares trust a wife or a child or a friend any longer. But in the future, there will be no wives and no friends. Children will be taken from their mothers at birth as one takes eggs from a hen. The sex instinct will be eradicated. Procreation will be an annual formality like the renewal of a ration card. We shall abolish the orgasm. Our neurologists are at work upon it now. There will be no loyalty except loyalty towards the party. There will be no love except the love of Big Brother. There will be no laughter except the laugh of triumph over a defeated enemy. There will be no art, no literature, no science. When we are omnipotent, we shall have no more need of science. There will be no distinction between beauty and ugliness. There will be no curiosity, no enjoyment of the process of life. All competing pleasures will be destroyed. But always, do not forget this, Winston, always there will be the intoxication of power, constantly increasing, constantly growing settler. Always, at every moment, there will be the thrill of victory, the sensation of trampling on an enemy who is helpless. If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stomping on a human face forever. Oh, man, I didn't sync the... I didn't say that right. Damn, I didn't sync the... what do you got? Syncing the delivery there. What he actually says is, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever. I guess it's not stomping. For some reason, I thought it was stomping. Now, you know, are we seeing any of that happening? I don't know. Stay tuned for part three where we'll break it all down. And Winston, he looks in the mirror and he looks, you know, wrecked and emaciated. O'Brien says, look at you. We did this to you. And guess what? Your mind is the same sorry ass state. This is why O'Brien gets the big old house and the wine, because he be breaking fools down. All right. Next is chapter four. They send Winston. Winston goes back to Gen Pop with the promise that someday they're going to shoot you and end all of this. And it's like, oh, okay. Something to look forward to, I guess. So for weeks or months, he's not sure. He's doing his thing. He's kind of brainwashing into this. He's trying to lean into this. Still struggling. The book says this. He had no difficulty in disposing of the fallacy, and he was in no danger of succumbing to it. He realized, nevertheless, that it ought never to have occurred to him. The mind should develop a blind spot whenever a dangerous thought presented itself. The process should be automatic, instinctive. Crime stop, they call it in newspeak. He set to work to exercise himself in crime stop. He presented himself with propositions. The party says the earth is flat. I'm not making that up. That's what it says in the book. The party says the earth is flat. The party says that ice is heavier than water. And trained himself in not seeing or not understanding the arguments that contradicted them. It was not easy. It needed great powers of reasoning and improvisation. The arithmetical problems raised, for instance, by such a statement as 2 and 2 make 5 were beyond his intellectual grasp. It needed also a sort of athleticism of mind, an ability at one moment to make the most delicate use of logic, and at the next to be unconscious of the crudest logical errors. Stupidity was as necessary as intelligence and as difficult to attain. So is that flat earthing a whole psyop to see who's susceptible to mind control? Maybe. Maybe that's what's going on there. Oh, pretty interesting. But anyway, he's able to... Winston is able to mentally put himself into that golden pasture, that golden country pasture, and think about his mom and all this stuff. So he's sort of dissociating during this whole torture sequence. But he's still missing Julia. He still loves her. Just like he says, like, they can't take that away. And they're having a struggle to get Winston to go full brainwash. And O'Brien comes in to check. All right, we're almost done. Tell me, Winston, and remember, no lies. You know that I'm always able to detect a lie. Tell me, what are your true feelings towards Big Brother? I hate him. You hate him? Good. Then the time has come for you to take the last step. You must love Big Brother. It is not enough to obey him. You must love him. He released Winston with a little push towards the guards. Room 101, he said. Uh-oh. Finally, we get to room 101. The dreaded room 101 now, which O'Brien, and we're in chapter 5 now. Room 101 now, which O'Brien tells him, this place is the worst thing in the world. It's the prisoner's greatest fear, whatever that is. So for Winston, it's rats. And they put a saw-type contraption of a cage attached to his face with rats in it. Would you like to play a game? And they strap it on, and they proceed to do the worst thing ever. Take a listen to this. The mask was closing on his face. The wire brushed his cheek. And then, no, it was not relief, only hope, a tiny fragment of hope. Too late, perhaps too late, but he had suddenly understood that in the whole world, there was just one person to whom he could transfer his punishment. One body that he could thrust between himself and these rats. And he was shouting frantically over and over, Do it to Julia. Do it to Julia. Not me. Julia, I don't care what you do to her. Tear her face off. Strip her to the bones. Not me. Julia, not me. Damn, they broke him. Because remember, he was like, I will love you forever, baby. And now he's like, I don't want these rats. Put them on her. Chapter 6. I think this is the last chapter. Last chapter, and we're done. Oh, we made it. So Winston, after snitching and sort of, you know, conforming, he gets out of prison. All right. And he's living the life the party wants, just drinking his little gin, predictable little schedule at the bar where he plays chess. They're always reserving the corner table for him. They're like, this is good for you. He suspects the bar is undercharging him because the party surely is facilitating this preferred way of living for Winston because he could be dangerous. So they're like, let's keep this fool pacified. Well, Winston, he doesn't spend much time thinking on anything anymore. And he's writing 2 + 2 = 5 on a dusty table. He recalls a story of how he saw Julia after their prison ordeal. And he approached her. And there was this cold distance between them. And Julia says, I betrayed you. And they talk about how they were given this torture that they could transfer to the other person and how it does this weird mental thing that makes you no longer love that other person after you do this. So the party knew this the whole time. They say they should meet again, but Winston realizes, he's like, I don't even care. He's not interested anymore. He's more interested in going back to the Chestnut Tree Cafe to drink and play games. And he recalls a statement from earlier in the book where it said, under the spreading chestnut tree, I sold you and you sold me. And Winston then has a flashback of walking down the torture halls of the Ministry of Love when we finally figure out why it's called the Ministry of Love. He was walking down the white tiled corridor with the feeling of walking in sunlight and an armed guard at his back. The long hoped for bullet was entering his brain. He gazed up at the enormous face. 40 years it had taken him to learn what kind of smile was hidden beneath the dark mustache. A cruel, oh, cruel, needless misunderstanding. Oh, stubborn, self-willed exile from the loving breast. 2 gin-scented tears trickled down the sides of his nose. But it was all right. Everything was all right. The struggle was finished. He had won the victory over himself. He loved Big Brother. The Ministry of Love, turns out, is about loving Big Brother and loving the state, your oppressor. Now, we made it through the book. We're all done. And the best part is yet to come. So right now, subscribe to the podcast, however you're listening right now. And we're going to continue on with part 3 on the next time I catch up with you guys. And we're going to talk about how Orwell was right, how 1984 became the roadmap to tyranny in 2025. Oh my gosh. So be sure to stay subscribed to the show. And, you know, again, if you want to support the show, you can go ad free, early access, hundreds of bonus episodes at one of 3 supporter feeds, whichever one you like. Patreon.com/Illuminati Watchers, the most popular, the one I recommend. We got a live chat, great times, all kinds of goodies. And Apple Premium is the easiest. If you're on Apple, you just hit the button. Or IlluminatiWatcher.com VIP section is the cheapest. But you got to copy and paste an RSS feed. A little quirky, but, you know, it's my baby, and I will walk you through it and send you personal thank you videos for joining up. It's a great time. So there's your options. But stay subscribed to the show because part 3, we're coming back. We're going to talk about why we're talking about this, okay? All right. Thanks for listening to the show. And until next time, stay positive.